Welcome to Electric Evolution with Liz Allen. This podcast is about the journey to a more sustainable future in order for us to be able to do our bit to achieve net zero. I'll be discussing a variety of topics with experts in their field in order to educate and increase our knowledge of clean energy, electric vehicles, and the electric vehicle infrastructure. So whether you're an individual wanting to make a difference at home, a small business, or a corporate, this podcast is just for you. On today's podcast episode, I have got Chris Rimmer, who is the Deputy Head of Department at Cenex. Chris, thank you ever so much for joining me. We've not met, but we've spoken on Teams before, haven't we? So lovely to see you again.
Wow, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here to chat.
So, Cenex, start off with, I want to start off with you rather than Cenex, because there's a lot to talk about with Cenex anyway, isn't there? So you've previously worked in energy and obviously you've been, I can't remember how long you've been at Cenex now. How long is it?
It's about 4 years nearly coming up, so been a little while. Previously I worked over at E.ON and kind of a bit of a background in energy. And between then and now, actually took a break out to help set up a theology college. So something completely different, project management, project director, and then sort of came back into energy and electric vehicles afterwards.
So what, okay, God, you've got to tell me about this theology college, flipping out. How did you get into that? You go from E.ON to setting up a theology college?
Yeah, well, long story. I'll try and keep it a bit short.
Go on.
I guess, so yeah, was at E.ON, really delighted to be on their graduate program. It's a great thing that we sort of try and bring a bit of here. There's a lot of us that used to work at E.ON here at Cenex. They gave me lots of different experience, helped train me up in kind of project management, got to do R&D projects. I oversaw a call center team as well, international experience as well as UK. So it was a really good time and got right into kind of connected home, autonomous heating and lighting, and how you use data around the home to make good decisions to help people and businesses save money. And I'm also kind of at the same time, personal life member of my local church, and one of the pastors there was a lecturer, like a faculty member, theology college, and they said, well, we need a project director, we need someone to sort of bring this all together. So I got a tap on the shoulder and say, well, do you fancy doing something a bit different? And so I was kind of employee number one almost in trying to put this thing together that was almost like distance learning. So you can imagine people that want to train to be church ministers or church leaders, you don't want to take them out of their community and put them in university for 3 years. You really want to train them on the job, because it's pastoral, it's about people, it's about putting stuff into practice. So I did that for 2 years or so, and then handed that over, and then got back in touch with some of my old E.ON colleagues, and they said, well, you know, we've got a position open here at Cenex. Do you want to come and start, get stuck into decarbonising transport? And so got lots to learn still, but yeah, getting back into the topic and really interested to be in our energy systems and infrastructure department.
Amazing. So please, can you do me a favour and tell everybody what Cenex actually does? It must stand for something for a start off.
It does. And I'm so glad that it's a shorter version of the Centre of Excellence for Low Carbon and Fuel Cell Technology. So, you know, you can't put that on the business card. So it's Cenex. We're an independent, not-for-profit research and technology organisation. So our mission's about helping transport of all forms get decarbonised. And we're divided into different groups. So I've got my transport colleagues. They deal with everything that moves. So lorries and lawn mowers, tractors, freight, ferries, kind of if it's moving around, they monitor it, understand it, try and get their heads around the technology. And then I'm over in the infrastructure and energy systems department. So here it's about the recharging, refueling, trying to do that without blowing up the local substation, trying to figure out the right number and type and placement of infrastructure to enable that. And of course, we work very closely together. I mean, we were set up 18 years ago, actually, by the UK government and the automotive industry. So that's before EV was kind of a hot topic or anything like that. The idea was to bring these new ideas and technologies down the research and development pipeline and over the sort of valley of death into commercialization. And that's what my colleagues who've been here since it was set up have been doing. And so it's a real privilege to work with folks who've been at this for a very long time. And now, you know, climate change is a hot topic, air quality is quite an important topic. And we're seeing the switch, particularly for lighter vehicles, and lots of really interesting trials going on. So it's great to sort of trade off their knowledge and their experience when they were pushing water uphill. We're now at this more sort of tipping point, and it's quite interesting to see everything growing pace. So yeah, we're independent. We're constitutionally non-profit, so that just means we've not got shareholders to please or to pay. And so that means we can figure out the right things to go at. Sometimes the questions that no one else wants to tackle, and try and bring some of our sort of expertise and analysis to bear on it.
And you've just said you've had people there since the startup. Are they still there now?
Yeah, I mean, so we have a good turnover of folks. So it's always nice when we get new folks in. They bring new ideas, they bring new energy, they come from other industries, be that public or private. But yeah, we have folks, including our CEO, Robert, who have been here really since day one and have been kind of waving the flag for cleaner, greener transport for a long time. And it's a real privilege to work with people like that who definitely know their stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like you said, pushing water uphill, that must have been a really, really really difficult one. You're not selling it, but difficult one to support when people weren't even on board. You know, at least we've got a portion of the UK that's on, well, probably more than a portion. But there's a lot of people that recognise the requirement for decarbonisation, isn't there? But I think we need to do a lot more currently to kind of push that agenda, because I know it's part of a bigger picture, isn't it? But it's just really important.
Yeah, I mean, I find it's a really interesting area to work in, and actually the fact that there are still questions means that I still have a job in some regards. So, you know, it's quite a complicated technical area. If I think about the stuff that I really work on day in, day out, electric vehicle infrastructure, EVI, you know, there's a lot of kind of technical, electrical, compliance, legal, regulatory stuff in there. So, you know, the fact that I get to watch what's going on, see best practice, try and repackage it up as advice or training or sort of guidance or strategies to hopefully help people make sensible decisions and routes through that, whether they're public sector, local authorities who are looking at local EV infrastructure, or private organisations who are looking to enter the market or enhance their offering. We work with charities as well, who are looking at kind of destination sites where people are driving and saying, well, yeah, I want to charge at XYZ site, or even whole countries. Yeah, it makes for a very varied and interesting job that I'm kind of delighted to do, really.
Yeah, I suppose thinking about it, it must be something that you know, every day is different for you. So I'm assuming one day you could be working with the government, next day you could be working with private industry or a local authority. How does it all fit together? Who are the ones that you work with the most then, or is it kind of like such a big spread?
Yeah, so I sort of say, if you look at the long term, we've got kind of four C's. We work with councils, companies, charities and countries. Nicely alliterative. I think in terms of my team around electric vehicle infrastructure, particularly at the moment, there's a big emphasis with the public sector in the UK here. So I'm sure we'll go on to talk about the local EV infrastructure fund, LEVI, but looking to try and assist local authorities and central government with their scheme sort of management to get charge points out, yeah, the right type of charge point in the right number, in the right place, under the right commercial arrangement, and do that in a way that is appropriately future-proof but gets good value for money right now. You know, that, like you say, there's kind of a wide variety of questions that need to be answered there. We do, of course, still work for some of those other organisations, and yeah, it sort of ebbs and flows depending on who's interested in working with us and who's putting out for work. The other side of things that perhaps I do less but my colleagues do as well is research and development. So often, yeah, delighted to be partnering with or funded by Innovate UK and others to try out brand new ideas or to try and build on ideas. So vehicle to grid is something that our department has a long history in. I think we installed the first domestic vehicle to grid charger at one of my colleagues' houses. Now the first one on a meeting room wall, I'm sure, because it's over there in our other meeting room, having not worked after a couple of years and sort of gave up the ghost. But you know, from then on, kind of trying to track with that idea, dynamic charging. We're currently just wrapping up a project that we've been working on there, use of sensors and data, trying to get into heavier vehicles, this week while we're filming. I guess after this gets released, we've got the Cenex LCV event, where I think our stand is based around sort of farm of the future. So what do you do with decarbonisation in an agricultural setting? Mm. So yeah, these sorts of customers and these sorts of projects come along from time to time, which are big chances for us to try and dive into topics that are as yet unsolved. Well, as many things are, obviously. Try and make our little contribution to moving it down the line.
Because it is just like a massive big jigsaw puzzle, all of this, isn't it? It's putting all these different pieces together and making sure they all work. So, you know, that's a big task in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I guess particularly because we come at it from a sort of technology perspective, making sure that the products, the solutions, the services, the underlying tech, you know, is it fit for purpose? Is it reliable? Does it deliver? But then, of course, you've got to have the customer angle, like in terms of the end user, is it meeting their needs? Is it making their life more convenient or more clean or more cost effective? And then, of course, there's a commercial angle as well. You know, right back to our beginning being set up by the automotive industry and the government, you know, how can we make these things fly? It's not going to be us that sell them. You know, there are folks out there doing the hard yards of getting the solution to market, making businesses out of it. So you've kind of got to get that tech, customer and commercial triangle sorted. And of course, yeah, that means that there's lots to be considered in there.
Mm, definitely. Do you know what? I'm just behind you. And for those who are actually listening to this rather than watching, I'm sorry, this won't make any sense to you, but I will tell you. So behind, you've got kind of like it's sort of like a map or a mind map anyway, isn't it? And you've got product development, partnerships, regional strategies and policy. I can't see the bottom one, but you've got innovative infrastructure, energy systems, vehicle to grid. There's lots and lots of stuff that you're getting your teeth into there. So where, how are you actually, I know yours is obviously the transportation side. Who in government are you working with then on the transportation side? I mean, like I say, I know I've just explained some of the stuff you've got behind you, but if we go back to transportation, who would that be that you're working with?
Yeah, so we do a lot of work with OZEV and really delighted to kind of partner with them on a range of projects. Obviously, they report into Department for Transport, you know, there's DESNZ as well around energy security and net zero, and then funding across those, you know, comes out in various ways or is steered in various ways through Innovate. But actually, increasingly internationally, so the UK is not always a leader in everything, but actually, you know, has a number of things where there's a weight and a length of experience that can be exported and applied. So working with Department for Trade and International Development, working for other folks who are trying to sort of put UK companies out there or who are trying to attract inward investment. So there's a range of government departments that we ultimately work for. I guess for my team, it's particularly the team over at OZEV at the moment. Like I say, it sort of comes in, you know, in phases. But yeah, it's great because it means that we are getting a bit of a front row seat on some of the policy developments going on and helping to try and support what is happening. So we're part of the support body for the Levi Fund at the moment, and really trying to assist with the execution of that scheme so that there's, you know, ultimately an improvement in commerciality of electric vehicle infrastructure. That's that kind of commercial point we talked about earlier, but also getting the sort of scale value for the public purse, serving residents and businesses who don't have off-street or sort of private depot parking, which comes back to the kind of wider strategies and policies that we have in transport, which roll up to the sort of wider policies and strategies we have around net zero as a country. So yeah, in that sense, you're playing our little part amongst the whole range of folks that are contributing there.
But your own contribution for that is quite in depth, isn't it? So if we look at Levi, for example, you've been working with OZEV, haven't you, on the technical specification for Levi. So for those, there will be lots of people that know about this, but for those that don't, can you just explain about Levi and how it works for local authorities and what this technical specification is actually about?
Yeah, so LEVI, as we said, is the local EV infrastructure fund. It's about £400 million set aside for local authorities to spend. There's sort of two pots. The capability fund is £50 million, which is really enabling the hiring of resource mm-hmm. in local authorities. Mm-hmm. So as those have sort of created the scheme, they were very aware that there is just often a lack of capacity and capability in the local authorities. You know, they've got sort of statutory obligations on schooling and health and social services. Yeah, it's a lot that local authorities have to right. deal with. And so, you know, EV charging can get sidelined, or it can be sort of the side part of a job in a wider climate change or a wider highways sort of department. So here, the funding is to enable the hiring of local EVI or EV officers who ultimately will be kind of playing a coordinating strategy delivery sort of role. And then the other part, sort of 350 million-ish, is really capital funding to help support commercial at-scale deployment of charge points, particularly for residents who don't have off-street parking. And LEVI sort of complements the Rapid Charging Fund, which some of your listeners or viewers might have come across, which is about equipping the motorway service stations and the sort of the main roads of the UK. So LEVI works, each local authority has an allocation of money, and then they need to put together an application process to show how they're going to use that. And then that, as it becomes approved, then triggers the release of the money, which can then be put together with private sector investment, hopefully, to make sure that we're getting as much scale as we can to reduce barriers to EV uptake. And so we're part of the support body, so our job is to advise the local authorities on making good plans and good strategies, and then on good project formulation, ultimately getting a good application, and then assessing that application and sort of passing that up to the OZEV for them to review and hopefully approve, and then sort of tracking with the delivery of that. And you can imagine that spans the whole sort of project development process. So you're right the way through from, you know, what even is an EV, which for some officers and folks who are new to this area is a very legitimate and important question.
Yes.
All the way through to monitoring and evaluation. You know, we've done it, we've got it out there, the contract is there. How do we manage it? How do we make sure that we're doing the right thing? And right in the middle is the question of procurement. And historically, local authorities have been sort of trialing and testing with more of a fully owned and operated model where they kind of do everything. So they take all the risk, they get any reward themselves, but allows them to control their projects much more. As we're seeing EV uptake increase, there's investment in the private charge point operators. They're able to bring sort of supplier funding to the table. Mm-hmm. Now the kind of commercial arrangement shifts more to, say, concessionary arrangements or to land leasing, where sort of the LA releases the land, or even to joint ventures. We see one or two joint ventures where public and private sector are coming together. So then the question is, how can we do that as well as we can? So part of our role, along with colleagues in Energy Saving Trust and PA, is to produce a series of products or documents and guidance, and for want of a better term, that is to try and bring or move us towards more consistent ways of doing that. And so you reference these technical schedules. We've got sort of heads of terms for concession contracts, which say these are the key terms we'd expect to see in a concession contract. Here are the options for what you might consider along the way, and here's what we think best practice looks like in terms of contract length, or in terms of who owns the assets, or in terms of how you might manage or influence the tariff. And of course, many of those hinge on the question of technicalities and compliance and regulations. And so we've got a sort of secondary piece of guidance that hopefully will come out very, very soon, which we call the technical schedules, which goes through a sort of smorgasbord menu of choice. So if you want to put out there a bit of a, it's not as tasty as a smorgasbord, let's be honest.
I'm sure.
Cutting through the dry content and the excellent work that my colleagues have done, you know, something around safety, or around data, or around what is a 7 kilowatt standard charge point, or any of these points that you might build into a specification, allows a bit of picking and choosing to build a specification. And our hope with that is to bring a bit of consistency. So really conscious that the private market is going to be out there bidding for stuff. So having the same terminology in the same forms, going out to market in the same way, reduces the overall effort for those that want to bring their investment to bear on these projects. But equally, it upskills and supports the local authorities, hopefully, to procure good quality high value contracts. So we're sort of trying to balance those two off. And yeah, like I say, just kind of putting that stuff out there, refining it as we go and we learn. You know, we don't know everything. We've taken feedback from lots of CPOs and lots of LAs as well, and sort of interested to see them get used in anger and then find out where we've perhaps not quite got it right or where we're landing in the right place and refine and improve over the next couple of years.
I was going to say, right, so on a concession, we're talking about, so when I think of a concession, I think of kind of the John Lewis of this, you know, where you kind of go into John Lewis and you've got lots of little shops. But that's not what we're talking here, is it? We're talking about the money that comes from the local authority and the money that the actual charge point operator is putting in for, you know, for the local authority. What I was going to ask you, you've got to tell me whether I'm right about that, by the way. But what I was going to ask you was, how can charge point operators afford to pay all of this? Because it's quite risky at the moment, isn't it? If you think about it, you know, at the moment we've got, what is it, 17% of cars on the road are electric. So it's kind of, there must be a lot of hedging going on with this.
Yeah, so I think it's 17% of sales are electric at the moment.
Yes, that was it. Yeah.
2.5% last time I checked of cars. But yeah, you, the number's absolutely spot on there. Yeah, so I guess the way to think of the concession is almost like the right to offer a service. So in the case of in John Lewis, I'm going to reveal my lack of fashion sense here. You know, like Dorothy Perkins has a right to sell with it. I don't know. I'm sure. All the people out there listening who are much cooler and down with fashion than me.
Going to tell me off, actually, people listening and watching, because I'm probably thinking Debenhams would have been a better option, but that's totally gone now, isn't it? So.
Anyway, moving on past that. It's the right to operate. And so I guess you come back to the question of why is the LA even involved in this, right? Why doesn't the private sector do this themselves? Mm. And there's a couple of reasons, and it will vary by LA depending on where particularly the cabinet will land on this, what political affiliation it has, and the kind of overall strategy and funding of the LA. But broadly speaking, local authorities have land and they oversee the highways. So they will need to be involved one way or another. Yeah. And they could just go, here's a car park, we're going to lease it out, get a ground rent, and what you do with it is fine. And, you know, that's fine, but if there's a certain level of service you wish to impose on that, you can't do that in a lease. So that's where the concession comes in. So look, you can have access to the land and a right to offer a service, but here are the stipulations you need to follow. And of course, then there is a sharing of risk, as you point out here. So, you know, the private investor is saying, right, well, I'm going to put my X hundreds of thousands or millions of pounds in, and I am expecting a certain utilization in the future, which will gain me revenue, which I use to make my return on investment. And so the key thing in the concession here is making sure there's a reasonable return on investment for the private sector. But crucially, they do need to have the risk of operation is on them. And that's part of really the specific definition of what a concession is. It can't just be the risk is kind of taken out of the game by the local authority investment. There needs to be a sharing of risk. And that might divide down in different ways for different projects. But broadly speaking, it's a kind of public-private commercial partnership. So coming together to work on providing something. And the LAs will want that because for many, there's a sense that this wave of electrification is coming. But for folks who don't have driveways, for folks who can't afford to buy new or even used vehicles, for people who are very dependent on their private cars, you know, this isn't necessarily an easy market to get into, certainly not at the moment. And so in the sense of kind of equity and fairness and balance, a so-called just transition, then there's a need to make sure we steer these in the right way to support particularly the areas where there's not maybe the strongest commercially viable case, and leave other use cases, you know, sort of service stations or fuel station type models where there is a much better case to the private sector to deliver. So that's kind of why the LA sort of needs to get involved, how they share the risk, what it is they're trying to achieve. And of course, it's not the model for everyone. You know, there are cities out there who want to own and operate absolutely everything. There are those who have this joint venture approach. So we're trying to be, you know, across those approaches and make sure that we're driving scale, commerciality, ultimately getting the right charge points, as I said at the beginning, in the right place with the right number on the right arrangement.
Absolutely, because like you say, if a local authority and a charge point operator has done their work, they will be able to theoretically, you'd be able to see what footfall is going to go through, wouldn't you, in order to make sure that both parties are happy. And then I suppose the concession or the terms and conditions, to me, I'd call that a service level agreement, actually, yeah, rather than, yeah, just, yeah, terms and conditions, because the two go together, don't they? The service level agreement is actually, right, okay, what are you going to do? But, you know, if it's the LA, the local authority to the charge point operator, we need you to make sure that this is, I mean, especially with the mandate that's come out for kind of the higher powered chargers, you know, we need to make sure that you are 99% reliable and that you can prove that with data. And because the other thing is, if you've got a council car park, it's got the council on the board at the front of it, is a user actually going to ring the charge point operator up, or are they going to badmouth the council?
Well, and this is all part of what we're trying to do with these schedules and the advice and the guidance is, you know, give the councils, particularly those that need it. You know, there are lots of councils out there who are going great guns and particularly spearheaded by, you know, officers who really know their stuff and doing great work. But mm-hmm. there are those who are still a little bit in catch-up mode. And in that sense, they get the capacity through the capacity funding, and then we're trying to build out the capability. And we don't have all the answers, but so far as we can draw on experts and others and bring that in front of them, you know, through kind of events that we run, through training that we're sort of planning on, through networking channels with sort of Teams channels where, you know, the LA officers are actually answering their own questions. You know, you say, what do you do about this? You know, has anyone got a template for traffic regulation orders? Oh, yeah, sure, here's mine. Oh, could I have that one too? You know, and kind of they pile in and help each other. You form a bit of a community, actually, where then the support body is there to provide the scaffolding and the structure and hopefully some of the knowledge. But actually, there's a lot of knowledge out there and there's a lot of good stuff being doing. So, you know, kind of sharing that best practice as well.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask you, so obviously, Levi's been a bidding process, as you've said. Was the take-up of Levi what Cenex and, you know, was it what everybody expected? And do you know how many local authorities are actually left over? Do you know what I mean? Because it was only a certain number in the pilot, wasn't it? And then there's been more funding this year. Yeah. But how many are left over? Is it a lot?
Good news is none, really. And the reason for that is, so there's definite pent-up demand, as we saw that in the Levi pilot. That was for some slightly more innovative projects that were trying to test the boundaries on technology or test the boundaries on some of the commercials. And then OZEV was able to release additional funding for others that were originally not part of the first nine, if I remember correctly, but were able to be part of a kind of extended pilot. But then because each LA has its kind of allocation there, so I'm sat here in Charnwood in Leicestershire, so Leicestershire has some money, and that is then spread across the whole country. Through the process, it's about the LA achieving a certain level of application, at which point it triggers the release of the money. So we want really excellent applications, and that way nobody gets left behind. And we can kind of drive the commercial and the bidding out into the market to get the best charging offer we can for that money, rather than having LAs compete against each other for funding pots. And so that's been quite a new way of delivering the funding, but it means that nobody's left behind because the money is there. And then it's about making sure we match the availability of that money with their ability to start to put those sort of project application proposals together. And so we've got some for this financial year and some for next financial year and some that are just, you know, hoping to be this financial year. But, you know, if some things slip, they might move into next financial year. So come March 2025, hopefully, all being well, the money has been dispersed. And then is with the LAs to start running these procurements, ultimately to partner with the private provider or providers that they select so that we can then deliver. So, you know, this is a program that's going to run on for quite a while, I suspect.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, so there's a couple of questions I was just thinking. So once the procurement process has gone through, so that they've been awarded the money, or, you know, they know that they're actually getting the money, and then the procurement process goes through, how long is it before they actually have to spend, you know, to have spent it by? What period of time, you know, have they got?
So there's no hard and fast limit here, and I think things will be assessed on a case-by-case basis. Clearly, because this is about supporting strategy delivery and breaking down barriers in advance of kind of 2030, for the first sort of big target, 2035, for all vehicles being, all cars and vans being sold, being zero emission, because of that, we want to deploy the money quickly. But equally, you want to do it at quality. So quality trumps time in that regard. So get the right application in so it triggers the release to the LA, and then it will be for them to figure out the right time. And of course, they're going to need to be sensitive to the market's ability to respond to those tenders, the supply chain's ability to then ultimately deploy. And so there'll be kind of installation programs and planning that, that sort of cascades off the back of this, and then commissioning, and then we're into operations. So I think what we should see is a real increase and expansion in the available charging capacity that's public funded, supported through Levi. Of course, in parallel, many charge point operators are charging ahead, no pun intended, trying to find their own locations and do deals, you know, at particular destinations or locations. So, you know, with those two sort of twin tracks, then we should see a sort of expansion that ultimately brings comfort to the drivers that perhaps are out there, and we know there are those that are looking around like, well, maybe I'd like to switch, but is the infrastructure really there for what I need? Well, yeah. So we should start to be able to scaffold and support that.
The amount of stuff that, I mean, me and you are both in the same WhatsApp group, aren't we? With the, there's 100 people in this WhatsApp group, and there's a lot of negativity out there, fueled by, and I always talk about this in all of the podcasts, or most of the podcasts, fueled by some, you know, the media pushing this kind of negative agenda, as you know. And it even affected in my mind, or actually, you know, around the Uxbridge by-election, you know, the way that things moved and the backpedaling that the government started to kind of start doing. Was that, did you start kind of going, oh God, it's, you know, does it affect you at all, that? Or does it kind of, like, as far as you're concerned, you know that you've got this funding and you know you're going to be helping people, you know, the local authorities and the charge point operators for X amount of time? Or did it start getting you a little bit, not quite sure about this, I'm not particularly happy? How did you feel?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I guess I can't speak for the high politics of the decision making that goes on and affects, you know, kind of the timing of these releases. And clearly the government will have its program, it has its announcements it wants to make. And, you know, we've seen in the news this week with concrete in schools, there are some really serious things that need to be addressed. And rightly, that will take up, you know, priorities. We don't want concrete blocks falling on kids' heads and stuff.
Not at all, no.
I think that said, our approach here is we crack on delivering, basically. So, you know, we want to see acceleration towards the delivery of the goals we think are important. You know, I think for myself personally, I come back regularly to that Public Health England report that says 36,000 people die a year from poor air quality in this country. And a significant proportion of that comes from road transport, from nitrous oxides, from particulate matter, cardiovascular, respiratory diseases and the like. And we have air quality management areas where the legal thresholds for some of those pollutants have been passed. Currently, our best solutions are move the vehicles somewhere else. And so with emissions that are much lower at the tailpipe for some of these vehicles, along with wider sustainable travel sort of plans to get people out cycling and walking and on the shared transport and public transport and the like, we can start to move the needle on some of that stuff. And so that requires really good project formulation and strategy, that requires good applications. And so we crack on trying to deliver, and you know, the politics will come and go and people take different views on this. And some people get very exercised by that. Personally, I'm like, let's get stuff done. Let's try and make it a bit of a cleaner place, and you know, do our contribution. And hats off to the folks who, I mean, you know, we're in kind of a research organization. We're not really delivering in the truest sense. So it's the folks on the front line, some of whom are our local authority officers, who are actually just getting the job done. You know, and so that's kind of where I tend to land on it.
No, I get you. Talking of poor air quality, I told you about, I've got a 17-year-old son, and I nearly did an embarrassing mum thing today to him, because we were sat We're both celiac. We're both eating our gluten-free lunch. Sat in Marks and Spencer's. There's a little food, a car park of Marks and Spencer's food in Reading, and there was somebody idling. It was 27 degrees, and she was idling, and she was literally sat eating a lunch. And I, oh my God, I was chomping at the bit to go and have a word with her. But my son was like, "No, Mum, no, you can't do that." And I actually got out of the car and sort of leaned over, you know, and she was far enough away from me. But I just thought, oh my God, do you actually not think about it? But people don't, do they? I used to think, I suppose I didn't think about it in the same way, but I do now. You know, and it's actually getting that message. How do you get that message across to people about poor air quality unless you're actually talking about X number of people die or have, you know, like that the little girl in Lewisham, you know, that died and it yeah. said it on her death certificate that it was poor air quality or air pollution. How do you get this message across to people other than banging on someone's window and going, "Turn your engine off"?
Well, maybe your son was happy that you weren't going banging on windows, but I think, you know, it comes down to providing people with the choice and the opportunity and, you know, where it's appropriate, the kind of incentives to think about the wider impact that our behaviours have. You know, it's so easy, I think about my own life, so easy just to buy something or do something. It benefits me. And it comes back, it's an old, old piece of work, that the tragedy of the commons, I don't know if you come across this, but you know, the little village around the green, and everybody puts a sheep on the green. So they're one sheep up, but they're one over the number of sheep down, because that's how much grass gets eaten. So you're like, well, I'll put another sheep on. So you know, everybody puts sheep on till the thing becomes overgrazed, and then all the sheep die. And I guess all the people die as a result. So you know, that is kind of the picture in my head around the actions that I take which benefit me. Ultimately, I get a lot of benefit from them. It's very easy to forget the wider consequences that has on others.
Yeah.
And so in terms of air quality, you know, I'm hopping in the car, driving place, it's really easy to forget, you know, what impact that might have on other people who might simply just be living next to the road. So, you know, that for me is a really, you know, I've no doubt there's ways that I could put that into practice myself better, but it's a strong motivator to turn up to work and, you know, kind of brings a really cross-cutting, whatever the political stripe, lots of people agree, it's good for us to have clean air. And I think of an LA officer who I was in a workshop with, and they said, you know, it's kind of unacceptable that we have this number of people die every year in our county. I'm like, well, yeah, we now have the technology to do something about that. And so little by little, slow by slowly, let's get that out there. Let's encourage people to travel more healthily and more sustainably. And you know, maybe some of those, whatever at the last count, 600 air quality management areas in the UK will soon, you know, start to drop down, and we start to see some of those sort of benefits come through.
Yeah, exactly. And you guys were involved in, there's been a letter going to government, hasn't there, about the legalisation of e-scooters. So it was 25th of July, I'm just looking on your website now. It's a joint letter to the Prime Minister. Do you want to just explain a little bit about that? Because thinking about clean air quality and active travel and actually we don't want to just be having EVs on the road, do we? We want to reduce the amount of kind of traffic that's on the road full stop and doing different things.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got colleagues who've worked a lot on micromobility, which is more than just scooters, they always tell me, and so I should repeat the mantra, you know. I suppose it's really simple. Is it really simple? It's really easy for someone in my place, or if you're writing a kind of strategy, to go, okay, let's take all the petrol diesel cars off the road and replace them with electric cars. And that causes a wider consumption issue. It doesn't really hit the congestion points. You know, congestion loses people time, it's economic value. Yeah. You know, there's kind of a wider impact of that sort of thing just sat in traffic jams day in, day out, particularly when we have platforms like this, which can work very well. There's no substitute, personally, I think, to being in person. But there are some tasks that are very easily, you know, replaced by this sort of digital interaction. So, you know, thinking more widely about what we call the vehicle park and how we manage down the number of vehicles on the roads in general, you know, if we can have just perhaps half, or maybe it's 75% or 90% of those petrol diesel vehicles replaced by electric, that's fewer batteries that need to be manufactured. That's less metal that needs to be put into things that are sat stationary like 95% of the time. And perhaps that opens up an opportunity to challenge, you know, we sort of say the Englishman's home is his castle. Well, maybe there's something, some similar phrase around cars, like I want my car on my drive for me to drive when I want it. Well, do I need to own that car? Could I share it with others? Does it need to be on my drive? What can it be doing when I'm not using it? How can we start to open up other ways of thinking about getting around? And of course, sort of personalized mobility, shared mobility, micromobility, you know, are key topics. And the good old e-scooter is a little bit a casualty, as I understand it. My transport colleagues will shoot me if I get this wrong, but of, you know, the kind of classification system. You know, unless you have an MOT and insurance and all these other things that cars have, it's technically illegal on the roads and on pavements. You can drive it on private land. Of course, there's a profligate market in places where they are being illegally ridden. And even in the pilot areas, you know, the sort of the Londons and the Nottinghams of this world, there's sort of the interesting ways of getting around, and they're quite popular. So it's one of those examples where the innovation has happened, and now something needs to happen to really catch up to enable this, because people love them and they find them very convenient. But we need to find ways to steer that so it's kind of, you know, a scooter barreling down a pavement at 15 miles an hour that runs into people. It's a pretty dangerous thing. But on the road, they're subject to HGVs, and we've had deaths and the like, sadly. So, you know, kind of putting the right structure around that to put it in its right place and to release that innovation, but within the right boundaries, makes a lot of sense. And that's one less car that's driving. So it's a little bit more space on the road. So, you know, a little bit more, less stuff manufactured or whatever, or whatever. So, you know, it's kind of comes back to that question of sustainable travel that we talked about earlier, and getting, if you like, the transport hierarchy right in terms of how we should try and move people and goods around. And so, yeah, hence we've been involved in all sorts of things. In fact, at the upcoming Levi Roadshow, we've got colleagues from Como UK kicking off with what's wanted from local Levi infrastructure. Well, you know, it's about kind of mobility and car clubs and this sort of thing. So trying to think laterally as well as, you know, what do we need to do for the EVs that, that we foresee coming on the roads?
Nice, brilliant, actually. And these road shows, you're having lots of local authorities attending anyway, and kind of giving them a lot of value. I just want to finish off by asking you, what do you want? What would you like to see the UK to have? What would you like the UK to have achieved by 2030?
Oh, that's a good question, Liz. Well, I think about just my area of work, there are lots of things I'd love to see achieve. You know, we could talk about poverty and hunger. We could talk about, all sorts of societal issues. The human condition, you know, we could really go wide on it. But let's talk about transport, since that's really what we're on about here. I think what I'd really like to see is an equality of opportunity for people to make a different transport choice. Doesn't necessarily need to be car to car, and for that to start to filter through into reductions in pollution and environmental impact. And yeah, I was just reading today a study showing, what was the phrase, it was like significant benefit in nitrous oxides in Birmingham from the clean air zone, you know, much debated in Birmingham and delayed, but I'd love to see more results like that where people are like, the air is cleaner, the roads are quieter, the roads are clearer. We're still getting around and, you know, able to go about our family or commercial business. And, you know, that's enabled by a bit of a shift into more sustainable transport.
I like that answer. That's a very, very good answer. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I'll come back on in 7 years' time and you can say, Chris, you said this. Look at all the things that didn't happen.
No, we'll go. Look at all the things that did happen. Come on. Right, so so Cenex, the website is cenex.co.uk. Chris, where do people find you if they actually want to have a chat with you specifically or your team?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a contact form and the folks on the front desk are really good at putting it through to us. So just say, oh, I heard Chris wittering on about transport again and would like to talk about X. I am on LinkedIn, so look me up, Chris Rimmer. And if you're coming, well, if you come to LCV, our big event that happens in September, you probably will be after this goes out. So let's invite you to September 2024. We'd be delighted to have a coffee. But we're in and around conferences and other things. So, yeah, happy to chat and to discuss and, yeah, to learn. There's a lot of good stuff going on out there and always interesting to hear what other people are up to.
And everybody can sign up for your newsletter. So news and events is on your website. You've got a newsletter on there that goes out, haven't you? So yeah, there's lots of ways, and I can see you're also on Twitter. So I mean, not you personally, but Senex are also on Twitter. So Just to say, thank you ever so much for joining me. It's been an absolute delight talking to you. I think you're doing some fantastic things within the organisation, you and your teams. Just keep doing what you're doing, and never think that you're not doing good things, because you are. And everybody's going to see that for what it is, because of the effort you're putting in.
Well, it's very kind of you, Liz, and thanks for your time and letting me on. And yeah, it's been a pleasure chatting.
Thank you. Brilliant. Well, listen, I'm going to say thank you to you. I'm going to say goodbye to everybody else. So until next time, I'm going to say goodbye. See you later. Bye. Thanks for listening to Electric Evolution with Liz Allen. If you want to find out more about Full Circle Continuous Improvement, please visit us at www.fullcircleci.co.uk. Don't forget to keep listening for more episodes coming up really soon.